Da 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 da.
Hi, I'm Nathan Inzarello.
And I'm Nikki Jacobs.
Welcome to Theater Couch Podcast. We're two actors, married to each other, who talk about theater so much we thought you'd want to hear about it. Every episode we'll dare to deconstruct a play, extract its larger meanings, and find some laughs along the way. This is episode one, and today's play is Eclipsed, written by Danai Gurira. So grab a beverage, kick off your shoes, and join us as we dive headfirst into the world of Eclipse, direct from our living room, comfortably seated on the theater couch.
Well, hey there, honey.
Hello.
How you doing?
Doing all right. Ready to knock this out.
I love your confidence. Well, hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to our inaugural episode of Theater Couch. This first season will consist of 10 episodes, a new play discussion in each one. And before we get to today's play, Eclipsed, we want to tell you why we decided to do a podcast about reading plays in the first place. A play is one of the most compact ways to immerse yourself into another world. Unlike film or TV, in which you are influenced by visuals, when reading a play, your imagination is required to flesh out the words. It's important that our storytelling not always be confined to just screens. In-person storytelling is still valuable and necessary.
Very nice.
Yeah, that was my soapbox. So how did we decide upon our 10 plays? The motive behind selecting each one of them was to encounter human experiences that are vastly different from our own. So, Nathan, what is your human experience? I mean, in a nutshell, please.
My whole life. Let's see. I am from an Italian background. I was born and raised in the Midwest. Very small town. I'll say very white upbringing. You know, fairly limited to other cultures. My parents did take us to Europe at one point and did travel. And so I got exposed to things. But for the first 18 years of my life, before I got to college, I could say everything was pretty homogenous. What about you?
Yeah, let's see. I was raised in Galesburg, Illinois. My father was a public school teacher, and both my parents were politically active and had a sense of culture just beyond our Eurocentric culture at home. My father was really instrumental in teaching Black history in elementary school and the history of other cultures as well. He even ventured into teaching Chinese history, Mexican history. It was really important to him to represent all of the ethnic groups that were at his school. My town was about 30,000 people, but we still had an Asian American population. We had an African-American population in the town. And he just felt like, you know, those cultures were completely underrepresented in education and wanted to recognize those cultures.
So you were very fortunate in being exposed to that at an early age, because I can tell you, in my studying of world history all through school, specifically talking about today's play, African culture, African history was not paid very much mind, was not focused on. I did not know the countries of Africa. I did not know almost anything about it.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the way it is in a lot of places still in the United States.
Yeah, I don't think that's unique to the Midwest.
No, it's not unique to the Midwest. Although, you know, it's changing. I mean, when I was a substitute teacher, I saw that there was much more of an embrace of other cultures in the curriculum as I was employed in the school districts. I remember that I saw that there was an improvement. But it's still not enough. It still, I don't think, is fully part of the mainstream. To use that word,
no.
For lack of a better word. But yeah, I was extremely fortunate because of my dad, because of my mom, you know, always pointing out that human beings are human beings, no matter the color of their skin or their religion or whatever. And that we should treat each other fairly and that really we should be interested in each other because we all occupy this planet.
Which brings us back to the theme of this first season, which is diversity. We've tried to pick plays that were, you know, as we said, vastly different from our experience. And we think vastly different from the average experience of learning about some of these cultures and stories and other places.
Yeah, because I want to point out that even though I learned about these things because of my dad's initiative in my hometown, learning about them is not the same as actually growing up within that culture and experiencing that culture. I mean, I'm still very much a white girl from Illinois. You know, that was my, you know, that was the root of my cultural upbringing.
Well, and there's a difference between a history book and actually hearing someone's personal story.
Exactly.
Even if it's fictional, it's a personal story, you know, sort of on the ground, if you will.
So let's get into Danai Gurira's. Am I saying that right, Nathan?
Yeah, you're saying
it right. I'm always
right.
Afraid I'm going to pronounce that incorrectly.
Gurira.
Gurira. Thank you so much. Danai Gurira. Tell us about Eclipsed, Nathan.
All right, let's get into the play synopsis. Eclipse is set in the West African country of Liberia in 2003. The main action takes place in a one-room shack, just worn, torn, bullet-ridden. It's the headquarters of a commanding officer for the rebel group known as Liberians United for Reconciliation and Democracy.
Ooh, that's a mouthful.
Yeah, LURD. This is how they, LURD. The commanding officer, who is never seen in the play, has kidnapped four young women through the spoils of war and made them his wives. Though we'll use that term loosely because they're essentially sex slaves. And really, he's kidnapped, he's kidnapped three of them. The fourth one he doesn't initially know about. So, anyway, wife number one is Helena, who functions as the matriarch of the group. And she makes the big decisions to, really, she bosses everybody around. But she tries to ensure the group's survival. Number two is Mema, who has actually left the household as we join the story to become a soldier for the rebellion. She's trying to pursue her own definition of freedom. Number three is Bessie, who is immature, unrefined, materialistic, currently pregnant with the commander's child. And lastly, there is wife number four, initially known only as the girl, who is the youngest but also likely the most educated of the four wives. A major inciting incident of the play is when Mema returns from the battlefield, and there's this immediate power struggle between her and Helena as to what the future of the girl, the new girl, should be. Mema tries to convince her that she should leave the CEO and become a soldier and not be bossed around by anybody and not have to have sex with anybody, you know, make her own choices. But Helena insists it's better to remain one of the CEO's wives, just kind of grin and bear it, rather than help Mema, because she knows she, you know, part of being a soldier is that you're going to have to kidnap additional women to become the sex slaves to the various warlords, and the cycle continues. So it's pretty bad choices all the way around. And then lastly, we have our fifth character, Rita, who works for the Liberian Women's Initiative for Peace, which I don't think is a real group, but it's based on a real group. I'm not sure. She makes occasional visits to the compound throughout the play and is the only person genuinely concerned with the future of the women once the conflict inevitably ends. So all of the women are forced to make horrible choices in order to survive. Survival is a big theme. And in the end, the question remains, you know, are these women going to remain enslaved to this abusive CO in order to survive? Will they become soldiers, you know, and just cling to this war, as we know historically is on the way out, is almost over? Or will they follow Rita in the hopes of making a better life for themselves?
All right, wow. This is not a light comedy.
No, this is a drama.
Yes.
And I think you've done some good historical research to kind of flesh
out
some of the things I just mentioned.
Well, just so we get an idea of the context of this in terms of actual history. Well, first of all, our playwright, Danai Gurira, is an American actress and playwright. She was born in Grinnell, Iowa, At age 5, her parents moved her family back to their native Zimbabwe. She then returned to the U.S. to get a B.A. in psychology from McAllister College in Minnesota. Later, she earned her MFA from New York University's Tisch School of the Arts.
Okay.
We've heard of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Her work as an actor includes the TV show The Walking Dead and the films Black Panther and The Visitor. She commonly writes about strong female characters. Other plays of hers include The Convert and Familiar. Eclipsed was nominated for the Tony Award for Best Play. And the play's first production was in 2009, and then later opened on Broadway in 2016.
Bit of a jump there.
Yeah. People don't realize it takes a while to get your play to Broadway. It takes some work. Let's talk more about this rebel group, LURD, that you mentioned, Nathan. It existed from 1999 until 2003, when the Second Liberian Civil War ended. Okay, so Danai Gurira is basing this play on actual things from history. Now, LURD's goal was to oust the then-corrupt Liberian president Charles Taylor. LURD was mostly comprised of two indigenous tribes in Liberia, the Mandinka and the Kron. Charles Taylor was a descendant of the elite group of freed American slaves who migrated to Liberia in the early part of the 19th century. Liberia has a history of settlers from America who had been slaves in America. All right, this complicated things because there were always conflicts between them and the indigenous people of Liberia. So this Charles Taylor, he eventually was, you know, put on trial for war crimes. Yeah, not somebody that you would want as your president. He perpetuated a system of greed and corruption during his presidency in Liberia. At the same time, LURD itself, this rebel group, was accused of committing their own human atrocities during their rebellion against Charles Taylor.
Okay.
As our playwright, Gurira, so skillfully presents to us from the perspective of the female characters in Eclipsed.
Yeah, they actually mention Charles Taylor. They mention several times, yes.
I mean, these are the major political players of the time. The LURD group and Charles Taylor. LURD was fighting against his presidency. They wanted him out. According to Deep Tron, in a 2016 American Theater article, Danai Gurira interviewed more than 30 Liberian women for this play's research. Some who were raped and doubly traumatized by seeing their daughters be forced into sex slavery.
Lord.
This was all happening during this Second Liberian War.
Mm-hmm.
Within this number of the women she interviewed, she also interviewed female activists responsible for peace talks that eventually ended the Second Liberian Civil War. There's a happy note about it. Women were extremely instrumental in bringing about the peace from this war. This was the first Broadway play to feature an all-female cast of Black women. The Broadway director of Eclipsed, Liesl Tommy, was the first woman of color nominated for the Tony Award for Best Direction of a Play. Yeah, I think it's time that we talk about the play.
That we dig into it.
That we get into the nitty-gritty.
All right, now that you all have...
Enough of this information!
Who needs it? I'll just throw out a topic here. And that is the idea of sisterhood.
Mm.
And it's a very interesting... I'll say dichotomy in the play. We have this household, in quotes, these women have banded together in order to survive. But along with that sisterhood and we're all in the same boat, there is tremendous rivalry. There is a hierarchy where number one is certainly, Helena is certainly the oldest, bosses the others around a little bit, makes decisions. If there are any spoils of war that the commander brings home, she decides who gets what.
Mm.
There's bickering, but her decisions are respected. And then everyone above that basically has dominance over the next one.
So it's like seniority.
Yes. Mema, sort of balks that system. Says, no, I'm not going to be subject not only to the CO, but also the two of you.
Right.
Especially when Bessie is actually a little simple, a little, what did I say a second ago? Immature. Mema is much more in control and certainly wants to be more in control of her own destiny.
What's really interesting about these characters, you're bringing up the hierarchy and the relationships that they have to each other. And I think what comes across is the evolution of women's rights.
Okay.
In just about, every culture that I've read about or encountered. And that is that in just about every culture in the world, I would say, men dominate.
Mm-hmm.
And women have to find their way. They have to somehow survive within this dominion. And women make different choices about how to survive. I think that's what we see in this play. In the case of Mema, she actually has notions of independence.
Yes.
Even if it's foolhardy to align herself with the men of Lurd, because they're just going to keep her in a subordinate position.
Right. Is she really free? She thinks she is.
She is on the right track in the sense that she knows she doesn't want to be a sex slave anymore, that she wants to free herself from that. In the case of Helena, she's surviving by sticking to her guns, doing her duty, watching out for everybody, making sure everybody's safe, kind of making the best of her position. Would you agree?
Yeah, and she's not necessarily defined as a sex slave anymore. She's more of the housekeeper.
She's paid her dues.
Yeah, in a manner of speaking, basically, let's not sugarcoat it. The CEO gets tired of the girl and really starts focusing on the latest girl as far as who he's going to have sex with.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
But she has found a way to survive just by being long-suffering, just by staying in the game and not being beaten down. Bessie thinks she's going to survive by being superficial, by having things, by being materialistic.
Yeah.
I just think that this is a really good representation of, and I haven't mentioned the girl either, the young girl, she can read, she has a little bit of education, she has some more modern ideas about things a little bit.
And she's the youngest.
Right. But even she is like, what the hell do I do? Guerrera is showing you a huge array of human choices that women make in order to survive male domination.
Yeah, like we said, survival is a big theme. It's interesting, you mentioned Bessie a second ago, and Bessie almost seems to enjoy it. Like, she's resigned to this is her life now. And she gets terribly excited and terribly happy about, like, ooh, it's a new dress. Ooh, it's some fake nails or a new wig or whatever is coming in. She gets really excited like it's Christmas. And
it's a defense mechanism.
And really sort of takes to heart that, like, this is her man now. Like, this is my husband, and I'm going to be a good wife to him. Whereas with Helena, she is more defeated. She is resigned to this, but she's certainly not happy about it. None of them, with the exception of maybe the girl, are thinking about freedom or thinking about what's going to happen after this. And we don't know exactly how much each of them. We know that the girl just got here and it's 2003, so it's almost at the end of the war. But we don't know how long Helen has been here.
Well, what I was saying before, I meant to say, not a defense mechanism, a coping mechanism.
Yes.
We're seeing a lot of different coping mechanisms. And it's interesting that you are bringing up the future.
Mm-hmm.
Because of those who are being enslaved by this CO, okay, between Bessie, Helena, Mema, and the girl, and that is what they call her, the girl, between all of them, they're making choices within the construct of the Civil War. They're choosing only from what the men have given them. Then we have this wonderful character of Rita.
Yes.
Talk about Rita, Nathan.
Oh, goodness. these choices that you're talking about, these choices for survival, are really highlighted with the interaction of Rita. Rita has a scene, I think, almost with everybody
yes.
alone, every single woman alone. And it's all very different with Mema. Mema is one of the first ones, and she's trying to, you know, basically bring Rita into her world. This is an upper-class, educated woman working for a peace organization.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think it should be pointed out that Rita was raised in, like, I mean, she was raised...
In Liberia?
Well, she was raised in, like, a kind of a rural place in Liberia, correct?
Yeah,
Because she does... When she speaks to them, she speaks in their dialect.
Yeah, and she... Well, the stage direction actually in the play says that she sort of slips into their dialect maybe to... I won't even say it that way. She puts on this dialect in order to relate to them. But the way the play puts it is that her upper class speak frequently comes out. So
uh-huh.
if anything, the dialect is a bit of a put on in order to make the girls she's talking to, women she's talking to, more comfortable.
Yes. And by the way, the official language of Liberia is English. When we speak about
That's
a
right.
dialect, this is an English dialect. It's their own particular dialect of English that they're speaking. But anyway, Rita, who offers a whole new world.
Yeah.
To all these women, making them see that they can change their lives.
There's a future.
That there's a future, and that they themselves can start determining what it is they have to choose from in life and what it is they want to go toward in life. That they don't have to rely on these COs, that they don't have to settle for male domination.
Yeah, and... Let's see, Rita, throughout the thing, I think it's important to note that this is really on Rita as an individual. The group that she's a part of has some pretty strict rules about interacting with all of these people in the bush. And that it's kind of frowned upon. Like, they don't want Rita talking to these women individually, which she does. They're like, we're just here to negotiate with the commanding officers, the warlords. We're trying to negotiate for peace. And
she takes it a step further.
Yeah, she takes it upon herself to be thinking about, well, this isn't unique. It's not like this one commander has taken on, you know, four women that he's kidnapped and raped and held captive. This is everywhere in this war. This is common practice. It's common practice for Mema and then eventually number four to every time they raid a village, they round up the women, you know, and give them this speech of, listen, you got two choices. You can either pick up a gun and come be soldiers and fight for freedom, fight for liberation, or you can go be a wife to one of the commanding officers. You know,
so-called wife.
You're right. How many times and how many ways do we say you're going to be a wife when really you're going to be a sex slave? We keep bringing that up, but there's no prettying it up.
And we shouldn't pretty it up.
You know, you try to survive, and meanwhile, throughout the play, it's this crazy ritual. Like I said, you never see the commanding officer, but throughout the play, you see this moment where the commanding officer has clearly walked in. All the women line up as if they're soldiers. I hate to make a comparison to the Von Trapp family children, but like, the commander's walked in, everybody lines up for inspection. He essentially points to one of them, they go out with him, have sex with him, and then very mechanically walk back in, wipe themselves off. It's a very terrible imagery. And then go about their day. And like, this is life. This is the routine. It's done with very little pomp and circumstance, and, you know, but it is a ritual.
I want to point out a couple things about Guerrera's writing.
Go ahead.
Because all of this is really heavy stuff. However, the play, I know this is going to sound strange considering the topics that we've been discussing, but the play is incredibly enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah.
The interaction between these women involves a lot of comedy because they're also very honest.
Mm-hmm.
About who they are. I mean, there's no pretense to any of them.
Yeah.
And so the interaction between them is very real and very down to earth. And a lot of comedy comes out of that because, you know, they're all so different as well, their personalities. And they're so steadfast about who they are mm-hmm. and the way they behave. So there's that part of it.
We forget how young they are.
Yes!
Through the reading of the play, we forget that number four is essentially 15 years old.
And number four is the girl.
Yeah, number four is the girl. Mema and Bessie are in their mid-teens, and Helen is supposed to be in her late teens and early 20s. So we forget all the time. We think that these are very experienced women in the reading of the play. We have to remind ourselves that they're mostly teenagers.
Another point that I want to make, yes, and they are, they're very young, which... You know, oftentimes we find with young people that they do wear things on their sleeve and are very open about things. Also, I mean, you mentioned what they go through every day. We'll call it the ritual.
Yeah.
With the CO. They're with him. They go experience that. And then what you see in the play on stage is them coming out afterwards and dealing with each other. And I think what Guerrero also shows is the incredible resilience of women. That they go through this experience, but they still manage to have some kind of a life together outside of him, beyond him.
Yeah.
That they manage to get along and take care of each other.
That's part of the survival.
And yes. Even Mema, in her own way, coming and telling them about, you know, I'm a soldier now and I'm doing this and I'm doing that, and Helena is criticizing her for it. Mema is coming there, I believe, to say to them, look, this life you're living, at least I have some semblance of power.
Yeah, I have some. Though I'm making choices.
Though it's still horrible. It's still terrible.
Yeah.
The things they ask the women soldiers to do.
Yeah.
But it's something that I get to choose.
Right.
Beyond this guy in the other room who simply sees me as a sex object.
Yeah.
So a lot of people, when they write about themes like this, political themes, cultural themes, they write about themes. And Guerrero wrote about people.
Mm-hmm.
You walk away feeling that you met these women and got to know these women.
Yes.
It's not just about themes. She wrote about real living people.
I am going to bring up one more theme, though.
Oh my gosh. I can't handle another one.
Based on something you said. Well, we've both talked about back and forth. We've said their real names. We've said their numbers. It's interesting that even amongst the women, they don't call each other by name for the most part.
Yes.
They call each other number one, number two, number three, number four.
What do you think about that?
I think that it is about the dehumanization. I think that it's a big deal. Part of Mema's story is that she's a soldier now and she picks a new name. And there's a ceremony to number four eventually picking a new name for her.
Yes.
That this is your war name, you know.
Like getting christened.
Yeah, almost like, exactly what I was thinking. Like almost like you've been baptized with a new name.
Baptized in violence.
From war. And it's another aspect is that it becomes a really big deal when Rita teaches Helena to write her name. And then she just keeps writing it over and over again. Her name is very important to her. And that's part of Rita's influence, too, is this reminder that you're a human being with a name. There's certainly symbolism there. I think on a very practical level, Helena can't even fully remember her last name.
Yes. And
we know she's been there, we'll say, from like 15 to 20 or whatever. That is bizarre that someone that old might forget their last name, but it's been that long since she's used it. That's just very fascinating. And I know I've read other stories that, you know, it's important to remember what your name is. That is your identity. You're not number four. You're not identified solely as this man's wife, that you're just a number now. So Mema gives number four that, at least gives her a name.
That's really interesting that you point that out. I had not thought of that. Mema, to me, is a fascinating character.
Yeah.
She's following the orders of COs and doing horrible things to people. However, if there is a however, And I'll say, and she had the guts to leave. She had the guts to leave. Mm. Now, unfortunately, she left abuse. Now she's in a position where she's being told to abuse. It's not a step forward. It's more of a step to the side.
It's better for her.
It's better for her. It's a selfish move in many ways. Mm-hmm. I think that she feels like this is what I've got to do for now to go on to doing something else later, maybe. She's the character to me that didn't fit in to this group. You know, Helena was always really hard on her, and she didn't quite fit in because she, you know, she was that type of personality that said, I'm not going to put up with this. I'm not going to be this. Hmm. And I'll do whatever I have to do to not be this.
Yeah. Even if I have to foist this upon other innocent women, which is terrible.
But you have to ask yourself, what would I do if I were in a similar situation? What would I do?
Yeah.
Do I have the right to judge her for this decision? What would I do? She is a change agent.
Yeah. It's interesting how many change agents there are, because Rita is a change agent.
Oh, yeah.
The girl is a change agent.
Yes, yes, yes. It's really Helena and Bessie who were kind of the staples of the household. They'd been there for a while. They knew each other very well.
That's how the play starts. We only, as far as we know, it's just the two of them.
Yeah, and neither of them had decided to leave. What it shows is that to escape violence, to escape abuse in this current society in Liberia, your one choice was to become that yourself.
So speaking of choice, without doing spoilers, that's how the play ends. All the characters are left with a choice of what are you going to do now?
Yeah, what do you do?
I don't think it's a spoiler to say that the war ends.
It's somewhat of a spoiler.
It's inevitably going to end.
The war did end in 2003, the second Liberian Civil War.
Yeah.
Charles Taylor was, in fact, ousted. He fled to Nigeria, but was eventually tried for war crimes. He was quite a character. That's a nice way of putting it.
As is typical, one corrupt administration follows another corrupt administration.
But you can... Yeah, exactly. I should say, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
But you can read more about Charles Taylor yourself. we'd like to go on to another topic. And that is, you were going to say... that the women, that they have choices. They were left with a choice. And after having not had choices for so long, they were left with a very big choice. I want to talk a little bit about our theme of diversity for this season.
Yeah, we can end with that.
We talked about the fact that reading about differences in cultures, reading about different experiences, brings us to an understanding of how alike we really all are as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the specifics are not the same, of course, but the things that we face have great similarity. And we should know each other's stories so that we know better how to face those things, how to be better human beings.
And it makes us more compassionate. It absolutely, when we learn about these people, we learn about how alike we are, but we also learn about the plight of other people. I think there's a real danger for all of us when we don't know, when we don't take the time to find out, of being callous towards it. I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know there was a Liberian Civil War, much less two. I didn't know that...
Yes, it was the second one. Yeah. There was another one before this.
Yeah, just 2 years before it. Like, that's, you know, that's how much this country was at war. I didn't know that Liberia was essentially started by... America trying to...
Well, it wasn't...
Well, yeah.
It wasn't started by America.
Yeah, let's be clear.
There were people there in what is now Liberia, but there was a movement to send either blacks who were freed from slavery or those who were born free to send them to Liberia because the endorsement was that they would have a better life over there, that things would be fairer for them.
Well, some people thought that was the only way. That America was never going to be able to get over segregation. The only way to solve this problem was to just take all of the black people back to Africa.
And mind you, this movement was from 1822 to 1861. Whoa. Abolitionists were against this movement because they really felt that it was really... white people just simply saying we don't want to integrate with black people.
So you still these people for a few hundred years, and then they're like, well, we're done with you, we're going to send you back.
And it wasn't just a small amount of people. Over that period, 15,000 black people from America, over 3,000 Afro-Caribbeans moved to Liberia, and what ended up happening was that they became the elite group. That they became the group that made the people who had already been there subordinate.
So they started dominating the indigenous people.
Yes. Oh, and Lordy. So this is one of the reasons, I think, why, you know, Charles Taylor was not an attractive president to indigenous Liberians who were part of this rebel group.
Reading plays is such a compact way of getting into these other worlds, these other stories.
This was a little slice of this huge event, you know, and when it's like this, it's done in a play, it's in some ways easier to digest, or at least you can digest it on a more personal level because, like I said, you get to know these characters.
Yeah. When I read plays like this, I have to sit with a dictionary or an encyclopedia app beside me, and I have to stop periodically. I'm like, because I'm reading this, I had no idea what LURD was. I had no idea. And also the play, like we said, is written in an English dialect. So you have to get used to that in understanding not only the different words being used and the different grammar structure, but also all of the references that are being made. And you could certainly enjoy the play without knowing all this, but I'll speak for myself. I always feel compelled to learn more about the subject after I've read a play. And during.
Well, I must give credit to this idea of being more alike than we are different. Maya Angelou said this, and it's always stayed with me. We're more alike, my friend, than we are unalike. And I think that that is why we go to see things about each other. I think that's why we go to the movies, read plays, see plays, watch TV, get involved in these stories, because we're being drawn to that part of each other that is alike. And along that way, we find out some differences, too, which enlighten us. So, did you have anything else you want to say?
No, that was great. I love the idea of looking at our differences and it highlighting our alikes, if you will.
Yeah.
So, I think that's it for Eclipsed. Thank you, Nikki.
Thank you, Nathan. Thank you, Danai Gurira.
Thank you, Danai Gurira, for this wonderful play. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Theater Couch Podcast. Today's play has been Eclipsed by Danai Gurira, published by Dramatist Play Service. This podcast is produced and hosted by Nathan Anzarello and Nikki Jacobs. Connect with Nathan at nathananzarello.com and with Nikki at nikkijacobs.com. We hope this podcast inspires you to make your own discoveries about Eclipsed. Join us next time for the play Rock and Roll by Tom Stoppard. Until then, we'll save you a seat on the theater couch. Dum 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 d